thank you so much, Delian, for coming on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time. Discovered you on Twitter and been following you on there, but also had the chance to do some reading on some of the stuff you've written. Obviously, you're well-known principal at the Founders Fund, also recently co-founder of Varda Space, previously principal at Coastal Ventures, head of growth at a startup, founded another startup in the healthcare space. Best way to start, I think, for people who may not be so familiar would just be to hear kind of your background, your story from, as early as you're willing to go to where you are now.
Yeah, sure. If you're saying as early as possible, then I'll start off with, I was born in Sofia, Bulgaria, grew up in a super Eastern European household, basically escaped communism because my, parents were basically good at math. And so we went off, both my parents became PhDs at Caltech, grew up on that campus, eventually moved to, Utah as my mom became a professor at the University of Utah and just, got grilled in the Eastern European household of, math, robotics, physics. And thankfully that all kind of, prepared me to end up going off to MIT, study computer science there, thought that I was going to sort of follow in the, footsteps of my parents and become an academic professor, PhD type. Suddenly sort of, in the first couple of weeks discovered, actually through, Bilal Zuberi, who's now a partner at Lux Capital, that actually ended up investing in Varda. So, it kind of, ties together at the end quite nicely, but, met him sort of second day on campus at MIT, ended up getting exposed to the whole world of like startups and entrepreneurship, ended up joining this like entrepreneurship club, going to these like dinners, ended up applying to, work at Square back in the day. That was my very first sort of the Silicon Valley job, was an intern at Square over the summer of 2012, and just got hooked on Silicon Valley and how much I was learning there and how much more, exciting and engaging it felt than computer science at MIT. And so I started strategizing about how I could make it out there full time. And sort of the number one path was the Thiel Fellowship, just because I'd actually been sort of friends or roommates with a guy who was friends with a Thiel Fellow. And so I sort of got to know that program, applied for the Thiel Fellowship, basically like the winter break of my sophomore year, ended up thankfully through a variety of kind of crazy circumstances, actually, getting into the program. And so sort of dropped out and have been in Silicon Valley now for the past, seven and a half years sort of since then. I've gone through a variety of different journeys. The first one that you kind of, briefly touched on, basically started this company in the enterprise healthcare space. We did okay, not amazing. Definitely, proud of the fact that we actually got to, a decent user base and, had sort of healthcare, clinics using us. It was sort of like a autism EMR, sort of workflow tool. We got to sort of, I think our peak month was around like 15K, MRR. So, not exactly like breakaway success, but it also wasn't zero. As a, two 19-year-old MIT dropouts, it turns out we're not particularly great at like enterprise healthcare sales, but we were at least good enough to close a handful of contracts. And so learned a lot about just like, fundraising, recruiting. We raised like a sort of 600K, kind of seed round, went through Y Combinator, learned how to hire and fire people, learned about marketing, learned about sales, all kind of the basics. But after about 3.5 years, we were kind of stagnating on growth, sort of flatlining. So ended up sort of, kind of soft shutting down the company, where we never really turned it off. It actually like kind of kept running. Even as I was a VC, I was still sometimes doing customer support for Nightingale. And ended up sort of taking a 1 year, sort of little hiatus break, and worked as the VP of growth at this company called Teespring, learned a lot there about how to be part of a sort of larger organization. We were like 300 million revenue, 300 people or so, had a pretty large team. And, just learned how to sort of grow a business line that was handed to me, how to, interact with a lot of other executives. It was definitely a significant career accelerant, even if the company didn't end up being, sort of super successful. I always kind of recommend to people, when you're offered, a seat on a rocket ship, definitely take it. But then also when you're offered a seat on the Titanic, sometimes it can be, an opportunity to have sort of outsized responsibility and help sort of right the ship. And so that was kind of a, Titanic situation. And we helped, take it from, basically, the plan was that they were going to run out of capital, and we instead got it to sort of EBITDA profitable, and it's been profitable now for the past almost 3.5 years. But then I was thinking about sort of starting a company again, and sort of got waylaid into the world of venture capital, because Keith Raboy, who had been sort of an angel investor in my company, he had been on the board at Teespring, basically convinced me to come join him at Coastal Ventures as sort of a half chief of staff, half EIR, figure out basically what I wanted to work on and who I wanted my founding team to be at Coastal Ventures. But maybe about 6-7 months into that, ended up discovering that my personality, skill set, and the things that I'm interested in were probably much better suited for venture than they were for being a founder. And so I sort of had this whole reorientation kind of moment about 8 months in, where I was like, whoa, I can do space stuff on day one. I can be my sort of ADD, intellectually curious, jumping all over the place kind of self. And those are all huge pros over here versus they're all huge cons as a founder. So that's how I made an adventure. And now I've been in venture for the past, 4 years, first half at Coastal Ventures, second half at Founders Fund. And as you kind of mentioned, most recently, with all this spare time in COVID times, sort of getting a little antsy and finally felt like it was time to incubate a space company. And it came together a lot better and a lot faster than I could have predicted, honestly, 6 or 7 months ago. Yeah.
That's great. That's a great story. And excuse me, it's pretty funny. People talk, well, a lot of people are bored. Not a lot of people take their boredom and then they go and start a space company. So it's pretty funny. You talked about like how you were entrepreneur in residence type of chief of staff thing, and then realized your variety of interests was actually maybe more applicable in VC. That's something that I can certainly like sympathize with myself. I dropped out of school and started a company. And then, more recently, as I've been thinking about what's next, I'm realizing that, the longer I can put off committing to like one specific thing and like a founder type role, and the more I can, diversify my interests, not for the sake of like diversification, but just because those are the different threads I want to go down. It's actually a lot more interesting to me and probably do better because of that. I want to, mostly talk about the present, but, and the things that you're doing now, Varta Space and otherwise, but I do want to, double click on one thing that you mentioned, part of your story, that's, participating in the Thiel Fellowship. That's been something that's been like super interesting to me for a long time. I was fortunate to have like Vitalik on the show who participated. Another person like Laura Deming, who's leading like some of the anti-aging work, I think is fascinating. It's just crazy to me how much success has come out of that program. And I think I'm hopeful that there's a way in the future where, less of a nonprofit and more of a for-profit endeavor can enable that for a lot more people and a lot more kids. You see like this year with COVID, a lot more people than ever taking a gap year. I took dropping out of college for me ended up becoming a gap year, probably the best thing I ever did. So I think it's super interesting. Would love to hear kind of the story of how you got into it in the first place, or how you got interested in applying, and then how it eventually worked out and what sort of the benefits were from the actual program itself.
Yeah. I mean, that summer in 2012, when I got that first Square internship, was the thing that really sort of lit the fire under my, sort of ass to get me super excited about Silicon Valley. And I basically lived in this like crazy kind of hacker house type thing where I paid like, it was basically just the cheapest rent that I could find. It was basically like $1,000 a month for like a bunk bed and like a shared room with like, a couple other guys. And I remember just like walking into the house, having my first week at Square and just being like, oh my God, like this is what I was meant to do. Like MIT, cool and all, and like, learning some stuff. But I was like, I've been coding since fifth grade. I didn't feel like I was learning that much, but like, man, that first week and being at that hacker house, and I was like, I got to figure out how to do this full time. And I remember literally like talking to everybody at that house. I was like, I need to figure out how to be out here full time. Like, I can't just go back to MIT. And so one of the guys that lived in the house, he was like, well, I have a friend that just started in this program. This was like, this is the second class of the Thiel Fellows. So very, sort of nascent program. He was like, you should come with me to this like summer event type thing that they're having. So went to the summer event, met a couple of like the Thiel Fellows. Hell, might have even been actually like, Laura, since she was one of the, sort of OG ones. And was like, this seems like an amazing program. I should absolutely, try to do this. And so, back then, Thiel Fellowship, it was actually like somewhat, the application process was a lot more about sort of you as an individual than it was about like a particular company or thing that you were working on. And so, spent sort of, winter break that year, filling out that application, then getting flown out later that May to sort of do the, interviews and presentation and meet, the extended sort of Thiel Fellowship team. I'm, extremely grateful for that program. I will say, I was in the third class of Thiel Fellows, right now, there's probably, we're probably on the maybe 10th class or 9th class. We're almost like a decade in at this point. They do basically one class of about 20 to 30 Thiel Fellows every single, basically May. It's a little bit more of a rolling basis now, but that's still typically when they at least announce it. And at the time, it was still like, pretty unclear what was going to happen with this program. Like, was it going to kind of be like a Y Combinator? Was it like, how successful was it going to be? And honestly, like 3 or 4 years in, like, I would not have predicted that it was going to be particularly successful, honestly. Like, the average Thiel Fellow wasn't doing anything like that interesting in 2014, 15, even the ones that had been in the program for a little while. But I guess it's one of those things where it's just like, yeah, if you kind of set people on this sort of non-traditional life path and they selected for some pretty weird, crazy people, like give those people enough time and enough resources in Silicon Valley, like eventually a set of them will end up, doing quite well. And so now you've got, companies like Upstart, which is just about to IPO, maybe just did, I forget the timing of that, Figma with Dylan Field at the helm. You've got Lauren Deming with, all her, research and VC, you've got Vitalik. So there's a wide array now, Thiel Fellows that have, done, pretty sort of, groundbreaking success. Austin Russell with Luminar. And then the other, maybe more surprising thing, I was actually just thinking about this the other day. I was like, it's impressive to me that this program has also just had such an impact, like personally, not just professionally, where several of my groomsmen at my wedding, like, are going to be Teal Fellows. And, you know, I'd probably say it's roughly, you know, roughly 50% or so. And so, you know, not only, you know, has the program minted a lot of, you know, sort of, you know, professional success amongst the group, but because it's a relatively sort of small and tight knit group, it's actually like quite, you know, personally connected as well. Like, you know, now the program's, you know, 200 and, you know, probably 50 or so people. So I can't quite know everybody personally, but from the, you know, Teal Fellows from the first, let's say, you know, five classes, like, I think I know all of them, like, personally, you know, for ranging from, you know, extremely close friend to acquaintance, but like, know all of them and feel comfortable reaching out to them, asking them for advice, et cetera. And so, yeah, pretty incredible, you know, pretty incredible program, and feel like I, you know, somewhat, you know, quite luckily stumbled into it via that sort of Square internship, Hacker House type thing. And then, you know, I'm super grateful for, you know, the opportunity that they gave me to basically actually be able to basically afford to drop out. Otherwise, I probably would have just like ended up back at Square and been on a maybe, you know, still non-traditional in that I dropped out path, but maybe more traditional in that I, you know, just worked at a larger, you know, tech company type path.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting to hear the personal aspect as well. You know, fast forwarding to current day, you obviously, you know, you talked about at the beginning, you're co-founder of Varda Space now. It's pretty interesting. Like, I look at Keith, you know, having co-founded Open Door while being a full-time VC, now you're co-founding Varda Space, full-time VC. That's something that, like, obviously it's not totally unique, but it's, you know, uncommon enough that, like, the fact that you and Keith obviously work hand in hand and you're both doing that. Keith's company is obviously off to the races at Open Door, Varda Space just, you know, early and getting started, but with huge ambition. You know, what makes you guys comfortable starting a company while also being a full-time VC, where that seems like something that a lot of people just wouldn't even, you know, think about doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is, you know, I'd say the average, you know, VC, you know, in Silicon Valley just doesn't have, like, quote unquote, like, that hard of a job. Like, it's a, you know, it's a job that, you know, at least when I started in Silicon Valley, was seen as sort of like retirement in some ways. You know, I feel like only in the more recent years has it become sort of like a, you know, hotter, you know, more sought after role. And also because that started to get sort of like more competitive. But, you know, I'd say, you know, part of that reason is why I felt like, you know, when I worked at Coastal Ventures, for example, it felt like pretty anomalous to see sort of how hard the partners worked. Like, at an average VC firm, typically, like, a partner, you know, manages, let's say, on average, if you divide the, like, latest fund size by the number of partners, you're talking about, you know, sort of 30 to 40 million. You know, typically a partner only has, you know, between 3 to 5, like, active board seats at a time. At Coastal Ventures at the time, you know, the amount per active sort of GP was, you know, closer to, you know, 5 to 6x that. And the number of board seats was also basically like 5 to 6x that. And so I think one could credibly say that, like, just the average, you know, KV partner, and, you know, now also at FF, just like works 5 to 6x harder than, you know, most VCs in the Valley. You're just like allocating a lot more capital. You're working with a lot more companies. You're meeting with a lot more companies. And they're just like, honestly, just, you know, having met a lot of different VCs, just putting more, you know, raw hours in the day. So I'd say part of that, like, let's say professional ambition leads to being like, well, I'm putting, you know, so many hours in, I'm competing at such a high level, and yet there are particular ways that I want to influence the world that I'm not seeing, you know, happen. Like, both Open Door and Varda really came out of, like, personal itches that just weren't being scratched by the, like, founder community, let's say, right? Keith had been thinking about, you know, Open Door. It was called Home Run back in 2003 for basically a decade, and was pitching people on it, trying to convince people to do it, with basically, like, no success. Like, he'd been pitching this idea of, like, somebody needs to do this over and over and over again, with zero success. And at some point, I think it's like, the whole point in some ways of, like, you know, doing ventures, because, like, yeah, you can, like, you know, make money doing it, but, like, the fun part of it is, like, really helping, you know, I think it gives you the ability to, like, have outsized impact on, like, the future of technology. And at some point, you know, if you've got this idea that you've been, you know, itching about and craving about, but you're not seeing anybody do it, at some point you just have to kind of scratch that itch. And maybe you're more comfortable doing it because you're like, well, I already sort of, like, outwork all of the, you know, all the average VCs anyways. You know, adding in an additional whatever 40 hours a week with, you know, another full-time job incubating a company, like, it's just, like, you know, the cherry on top of the cake. And it's worth it because it's this particular idea that I've been thinking about. And so that was kind of how, you know, Varda came to be as well. I'd been thinking about sort of in-orbital manufacturing for almost a decade. Had been sort of talking to friends about it, pitching founders on it, you know, analyzing the various companies in the space, but nobody's quite doing it the right way. And at some point, there's sort of like the summer of this year where I just had just like this like flashpoint of frustration where I was like, I'm just going to be looking another 5 years down the line and looking back and being like, still nobody's doing this the right way. And so I was like, I just think I need to, you know, kind of pursue this. And so, you know, there's huge opportunity costs. Like, you know, you, at the end of the day, it is going to eat into the VC time. But it can be worth it if the company has an outsized outcome. And in particular, especially with both, you know, Keith with Open Door, you know, let's say Trey Stevens, Andrew, and myself with Varda, it can also sort of make you a sort of, you know, lightning rod for, the types of company or all the companies in the. If you're starting a real estate company now, like everybody goes and pitches Keith. If you're starting a defense company now, everybody goes and pitches Trey. The goal with Varda is also that whenever anybody's starting a space company, they come and pitch, you know, me, because they see that I'm one of the few people that is sort of both investing in space companies, but then also have the experience of having started one. And so there are some, you know, let's say dual uses to the time, and, you know, it's not, you know, it's not like the time towards Varda doesn't have any application or use on like the VC side of my business. But realize that there's basically a huge opportunity cost, set myself a sort of list of requirements of like, okay, in order to do this, I would want like an absolutely killer CEO that was like high up at SpaceX, really well respected on the Dragon project, and like has entrepreneurial ambitions and has like leadership experience. And I'd want a chief scientist that had basically done microgravity manufacturing before. And like the first one, there's maybe like 20 people I could recruit from. The second one was like 5. And so I remember telling my girlfriend in July, I was like, there's just no fucking way I'd pull this off. Just like, you know, there's just so few people for me to pull from, the likelihood of them being available, interested, like wanting to work on this with me, you know, taking the sort of incubation deal, just, you know, super unlikely. I put it at like, you know, sub 5% chance. But yeah, unfortunately over the past, you know, 6 months or so, that chance went from 5 to 100%. And so now all of a sudden, you know, I remember, you know, as we were starting to like pitch VCs, I felt like I was like staring down the barrel of a shotgun where I was like, oh my God, like I pointed the shotgun at myself and now I actually have to like do the damn thing. But yeah, it's worth it for the idea. And yeah, it's a lot less, you know, sleep. And, you know, I kind of tweeted this somewhat facetiously, you know, about a couple of days ago, but I've definitely been feeling it over the past week of just, you know, if you want work-life balance, I definitely don't recommend like working really, really hard as a VC and, you know, working at like a place like Coastal Ventures or Founders Fund where like, you know, you just have a lot more responsibilities. But then I especially don't recommend having a second full-time job on top of that. It means you don't really get much time outside of work. It's just work balance.
So in short, the answer is basically you just have to like work really hard, and that's you know, there's a lot of details, but it comes down to that. It's pretty funny. You talk about like, you know, there's maybe 20 people at SpaceX that you could choose from for the one role, like the CEO kind of type, and then for like chief scientist there was maybe 5 people in the world that would kind of fit the bill. You were fortunate to kind of get those people and co-found the company together. Do you think about, you know, how do you contrast that versus what, you know, Teal talks about, which is, you know, you want to have a history with your founders. You want to like have, you know, your founders be long-term friends who you know and trust. It just makes everything a lot easier. How do you think, you know, you can overcome that having just, I don't know if you, maybe you do have background with some of these people, but was that a consideration at all in thinking about like co-founding this company and just like finding someone versus actually, you know, having the people already who you know historically?
It's interesting. Yeah, I actually didn't know that, you know, Peter speaks a lot, obviously, publicly. And so I wasn't aware of this particular like belief of his, but it's actually one that I'd probably relatively strongly disagree with. You know, the kind of, you know, quote, and this is definitely a Keithism, like I can't, you know, sort of claim this, but, you know, helped sort of dig into the data on this for him as well. But if you look at the sort of technology companies that have IPO'd over the past decade, there's actually like pretty limited correlation between the amount of time that the sort of co-founders knew each other before starting the company and the net success of the company. And so, you know, Keith sort of took this approach with Open Door as well, right? Like all the co-founders of Open Door didn't really have much history with each other and didn't know each other. You know, the analogy that I always like that Keith always uses is, you know, a lot of the most successful startups look a lot closer to producing a film than they do, you know, sort of other projects where, you know, there's a script writer that comes up with the script and then you go out and have a casting director that goes and finds the like best actors for each individual role. But it's not like a requirement that those actors have necessarily like worked with each other in order to have chemistry. If you just do a really good job as a casting director, you will just cast people that by default will have great chemistry, right? And so that was sort of the thesis behind, okay, I needed to be able to be such a great casting director that I could find sort of world-class people. And not only do they have the necessary skill sets, but also the like, you know, meshing personalities, both with each other and myself, such that they could, you know, work well together. And so it definitely, you know, sometimes can be, you know, more difficult and require a lot more like search costs. But I think those types of companies in some ways can be even more successful than sort of, you know, as an example, you know, my original startup was sort of this, closer to the Peter type example of like, you know, knew each other well, you know, had similar skill sets, similar backgrounds, but in some ways that ended up like not working out great for the company because like you basically just had two MIT computer scientists and we had, you know, limited diversity in our background and skill sets. And, you know, that ended up like not working super well for us when it came to tackling problems that were outside of our skill sets, you know, versus, you know, the founding team of Varda comes from, you know, extremely sort of, you know, different, you know, background skill sets, you know, personalities, and that ends up actually, you know, meshing quite well together. So, yeah, I guess, you know, there's different approaches obviously to building startups. It's not like Peter's, you know, totally, Peter's point is totally untrue. Like I'm sure that if you look at like just the entire system, that, you know, how often are there co-founder disputes when the founders haven't known each other for a long time? I'm sure that there are more when they haven't known each other. But in this particular case where you have a sort of VC as the incubator and VCs tend to be very good, quote unquote, like casting directors, because we've just seen so many different sort of founding team pair ups and how they mesh well together. I think you can kind of take a slightly, you know, different approach than sort of the approach that Peter recommends.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think one of your guys, you know, outside looking in, one of the big things that makes Founders Fund so successful is you guys take, you know, no reservations in disagreeing with each other and thinking for yourselves. And almost everyone's like independently a contrarian, which ends up bringing a lot of interesting ideas to the table and sometimes conflicting ones that can both be true in different situations. Let's talk about Varda Space specifically. There's not a whole lot of public information. I don't know how much, you know, you're comfortable sharing here on the podcast. I know like basically that, you know, you're focused on, like you said, orbital manufacturing special products in space. Can you do like a brief intro? And then there's a couple of things that like I did find that I can ask about, but would love to hear just like the brief intro of what you can share.
Yeah, I think, you know, when people think of space factories, they think of something like, you know, truly fantastical and out there. But the way to sort of like simplify it and make it sort of more relatable is there are a wide array of products that are valuable to people on Earth and increase our quality of life down here that can only be manufactured in a microgravity environment, i.e. in space. And there are people that have shown this via research on the ISS and have even brought some of these products back down at a small scale. Varda is basically focused on commercializing that research and making it so that we have sort of large scale supply chains that manufacture products up in space, but then are brought back down to Earth. And so at the end of the day, like our end customers have no clue that our stuff got made in space, right? Like we're not a space factory that makes stuff for space. We're a space factory that makes stuff for Earth. And most of our customers on Earth have no clue that their product came from a space factory. So that's kind of the, you know, sort of simplest introduction to kind of what we're doing.
Right. Can you talk a little bit more about like some of those products that make the most sense? Like I read that, you know, it's gotta be it's super sensitive products, like super high cost products. I even read like, you know, organs, like man-made or rather, I guess, robot made organs, robot made meat. Why, like what makes a product, you know, you talked a little bit about the microgravity aspect, but like, why can't you build certain products on Earth that you can build in space? Or at the very least, why are they cheaper to do so in space?
Yeah, the high level physics of it comes from basically controlling crystals. So basically on Earth, you have sedimentation, you have convection, you have gravity. These things cause, you know, maybe a really high level example that's easy for your audience to understand is like, imagine trying to 3D print a human heart, right? The classic problems that are really difficult in 3D printing are like super thin walls and like complicated shapes, right? And as you can imagine, a heart has many thin walls and many complicated shapes. And so if you were to start to try to print that on Earth, the moment that you have this like super thin wall, it would basically start to like flop over in a gravity field because it wouldn't be able to hold itself. Because like the only way that a heart really holds the structure is once the entire thing has been built, right? You can't like build sort of the bottom third of it because the bottom third, all of those like, you know, walls within your heart will basically start to flop over and then you can't continue to 3D print them. But the quote unquote flopping over doesn't happen when you're not in a gravity field, right? And so because of that, you can actually much more precisely control how you grow tissue. The same thing is sort of true with, you know, everything from semiconductors to fiber optic cables to carbon nanotubes. Basically, if you remove gravity from the equation, you can control these very delicate materials and how they're produced in a much more precise fashion because they're in a sort of uncontrolled environment, right? Like there's nothing affecting them. They're in vacuum, there's no gravity, there's no sedimentation, there's no convection. The only thing being applied to them is whatever you do in your manufacturing process. Like the other way to think about it is like the law of physics in our factory are just fundamentally different than the law of physics on every factory on Earth, right? So, you know, the Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturing lines, they all have to operate all of their processes and the way that they build things inside of a gravity field. And it turns out if you remove that gravity field, there's a lot of things that get a lot easier. And so hell, one day I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, Apple is developing their next, you know, whatever M5 silicon chips in space rather than on Earth, because you can just do them at much cheaper rates, much higher yields, much higher quality in space than you can on Earth. So yeah, happy to dive into any one of those, you know, examples, but that's kind of the way to think about it, is like remove gravity and controlling these types of manufacturing processes gets a lot easier and a lot cheaper.
Yeah, I don't want to get super technical like on the podcast, but that's a good overview. That's helpful and certainly like lays out the groundwork for, you know, what are the things that make most sense and why. How did you get into space in the first place? And how much of, you know, how much it was of actually starting Barter Space was like a personal thing, like a, you know, you just kind of had it with not seeing this thing exist and wanted to make it yourself versus, you know, kind of the question, the easiest question and the most obvious question to like the why now for your company to me would seem to be, and you know, I think it's been written about a little bit as well in relation to Barter Space is like, you know, the rapidly decreasing cost of launch, you know, of rockets. And, you know, I think you even said in one of your Substacks that it was like almost Moore's law for launch costs.
Yeah, the primary motivation behind it is like at the end of the day, the reason that I'm excited about space is because I want to help, you know, humanity explore that next frontier. But then in particular, I think orbital manufacturing has been an underappreciated area because most people have just been focused on basically like satellites plus launch. But at the end of the day, you know, look at where I am right now in California. California was not developed by the government paying for, you know, Lewis and Clark to go on exploration missions. California was developed because of the gold rush, and orbital manufacturing to me is the equivalent of that gold rush for space, where if you industrialize and create commercial supply chains in low Earth orbit, that will significantly accelerate humanity's path into the stars, way more so than just sending a huge rocket filled with people, you know, to Mars or the moon. Because at the end of the day, like the way that exploration and consistent like supply chains happen is via commercialization, not through sort of like one-off attempts or state-funded endeavors. And so that was sort of like the primary motivation. And for sure, yeah, the why now, and sort of in particular in July, why I had this like flashpoint frustration was like, the launch costs were dropping even faster than I expected. You know, Falcon 9 has now, you know, had several rockets that have launched for, you know, there was a rocket that launched for the first time in May, and by the end of the year had gone on 6 different launches. Like, I definitely thought they were going to get through reusability relatively quickly, but like not this quickly and not at this level of scale. And so both with Falcon 9 reusability, but then also having some, you know, pretty close friends working on the Starship project talking about, you know, right now SpaceX on their website lists at $5,000 a kilogram, you know, rapidly decreasing down to, you know, targeting roughly $3,000 over the next year or two. But, you know, my friends on Starship are, you know, basically guaranteeing me that they'll get to $50 to $100 a kilogram once they get Starship up and going by 2025. And so I, you know, pretty credibly believe those numbers. Maybe it'll slip by a year, maybe by 2 years, but it's not going to slip by much more than that. And at the end of the day, with orbital manufacturing, that cost per kilogram is the thing that really matters, right? Because the way that you can kind of think about it is it costs you a certain amount per kilogram to send something to space, but then there's also a certain benefit per kilogram of manufacturing something in space, right? Like when we're manufacturing semiconductors, we have to compare those economics to the, you know, Taiwanese semiconductor industry. And there's for sure benefit in space, but the, you know, dollars per kilogram benefit needs to be greater than obviously the cost of sending something to space. And so as those launch costs get cheaper and cheaper, the types of products and the volume of products that are more profitably manufactured in space continues to increase. And so I sort of started to see this curve, and I was like, now is the time to start an orbital manufacturing company, not 5 years from now when, you know, Starship is up and going, because then you'll sort of be too late to the curve and won't be able to take, you know, sort of full advantage of it. Cause there's just like there's a lot of sort of in-house domain expertise that you need to build up of just like how to manufacture things in orbit, right? Like nobody's made semiconductor manufacturing lines in microgravity. Like everybody relies on gravity for a lot of different sort of fail safes and components of the manufacturing process. You need to remove that. And so not only the actual manufacturing, but then also just the supply chain. How do you get things up there? How do you get them back down? How do you deliver them to your customers? How do you package them? There's a lot that sort of needs to get built out in parallel with the drops in launch costs, not like, you know, waiting for Starship to be done and then only then, you know, starting down the orbital manufacturing path.
So, you know, you talk about all the different complexities. You guys raised $9 million seed funding. Like, you know, I don't really know too much, but it doesn't seem to me that that gets like a lot done in like a space, you know, related industry. But I understand you guys aren't actually like going to be building the rockets yourself. So there's things that you can do with that $9 million. Would just be curious to hear like high level, what you expect to do with that seed funding that you can then kind of get to the next point in the chapter, raise some more money and keep going from there?
Yeah, what I'd say is space has gotten a lot cheaper over the past decade. And so, yeah, a project like this, even 5 years ago, would have required a minimum $100 million raise and probably a, you know, 150-person engineering team to really make it work. Thankfully, we can sort of make our, you know, MVP space factory that we'll be setting up, you know, ideally, you know, in the next couple of years with, you know, not much more capital than we've already raised, actually. You know, it's going to require a little bit more, but, you know, not much more. And so, yeah, thankfully space has gotten, you know, a lot cheaper than you'd expect. And, you know, we'll have more, you know, out in the public soon discussing sort of, you know, our plans and our timelines and things like that. But yeah, I think it might seem counterintuitive, but, with $9 million, you can actually go quite far in space nowadays, especially in comparison to what you could do 5 years ago.
Yeah. And that's why I wanted to preface. I don't know much, but it just seems like, you know, you guys have huge ambitions and obviously this is just the first raise and a very substantial seed, but I wanted to hear kind of what step one was. So that's
yeah. Step one's kind of just like the MVP of the space factory, right? Like prove you can do it at a small scale. And if so, then both commercial partners, DOD, other VCs are very interested in sort of seeing that, you know, system scale up both through, you know, economic benefit, defense benefit, you know, actual commercial benefit, you know, tons of different parties that are excited to see something like this come to fruition.
So you made the analogy to California with the gold rush earlier. This is again something that I don't know like too much about, but just from, you know, studying Bitcoin and crypto, I've heard people talk about how like gold, while we appreciate it as being, you know, definitely scarce, there could be technologies in the future such as asteroid mining that could potentially discover gold elsewhere or like deep sea underwater as well. And I don't know if it's like literally gold, but I know asteroid mining is something that a lot of people are interested in. I haven't really done too much research myself, but we're curious if that's at all part of kind of the roadmap for Varda.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely am a person that's super excited by, again, furthering humanity's reach into the stars and asteroid mining and sort of in situ resource utilization, i.e. using resources not from Earth to develop space, but from space to develop space are things that I'm super excited about. But the problem that I have with a lot of these ideas and paths that people are pursuing is like nobody has a use for those resources. Like if I brought an asteroid with a ton of materials into low Earth orbit today, nobody would have any clue what to do. We don't know how to bring that down to Earth safely to use the materials down here. We don't know how to use those materials in orbit. And so that's why it's such a key component of the path is taking the first very bite-sized approach, which is early on, we're going to be taking things from Earth, making them in orbit, and then bringing them back down. But eventually, we don't need to get the raw materials from Earth. Eventually, we can get those raw materials from asteroids, from the moon, et cetera. But we need to set up that supply chain first that is utilizing resources from Earth before we can even start to think about utilizing resources from outside Earth. Because even if you brought those resources right now into orbit, again, nobody would have any clue what to do with those resources. And so for sure, in our long-term ambitions, we would like to pursue those, whether it's, you know, lunar ice mining or, you know, bringing asteroids into low Earth orbit and utilizing those raw resources. Definitely things that we want to do. And we think whether, you know, we're the primary customer for those or how we even do it ourselves, that having something like Varda set up in low Earth orbit makes a lot of these other ideas much more technologically viable.
Yeah, it's certainly an exciting roadmap, and I'll look forward to you know, following along and seeing, you know, as you guys start to release some more information publicly, what's going on, and hopefully, you know, following the progress over the years to come. Let's bring things back to Earth a little bit. One interesting investment that you've made that I read about on your Substack was a company called Cover. You know, they're building houses on Earth and starting specifically with like additional dwelling units, ADUs. And it seems like for me, like a cookie cutter business for Founders Fund, both, you know, but from like Peter's philosophy to Keith to yours, I assume there's some overlap, and it's like, you know, a super vertically integrated business where they're taking care of everything for people who are interested in these ADUs. Can you talk a little bit about that investment and like why you're excited about the possibility that, you know, homes can be more modular and, you know, really disrupt the high prices for housing that we have today?
Yeah, I mean, through, you know, the mentorship from Keith and exposure to Open Door and a variety of different companies, just got a ton of, you know, exposure to the real estate and construction industry. And over the past couple of years, had met a lot of different companies doing everything from, you know, multifamily units, high rises, ADUs, single family homes, and trying to, you know, innovate on, you know, the technology surrounding construction. And unfortunately, most of the companies that I've met, didn't actually tackle like the core economic lever of construction, i.e. how the homes actually get built. Like there are a lot of people, you know, building, you know, software to try and, you know, coordinate. There are people trying to, you know, move the labor offsite, like, you know, companies like, you know, Katerra. But at the end of the day, they're still sort of using the same sort of plumbers, electricians, drywallers that traditional home construction does. And at the end of the day, because of that, there's just limited ability to significantly improve the, you know, economics of home construction if you're still basically using the traditional techniques and just throwing a, you know, software layer on top of it. Now, there were some companies that were sort of pursuing the world of, let's say, like 3D printing of homes, which was fundamentally obviously changing the construction techniques. But having, you know, looked at a lot of these, you know, 3D printed homes, they're not homes that at least I would want to live in. And so because of that, it's hard for me to get super excited about investing in them. And so Cover was actually the first company that I met that was both one producing homes that I would actually personally like want to live in. Like I am, you know, very much looking forward to one day, you know, building, you know, being able to afford to build my first Cover. But then second, they're the only ones in the market, and still to date, you know, this is effectively the case, that are actually like fundamentally changing the way that the homes actually get constructed in terms of the type it's utilized in the construction. And it's primarily because they basically took a bunch of basically ex-Tesla engineers and applied the philosophy of automotive lines to home construction, meaning that rather than basically having super high skilled labor doing individual tasks like, you know, drywall, electrician, plumbing, et cetera, they instead had a ton of extremely difficult in-house full stack software that they built that will take the basically designs of, and they don't do just ADUs, they also do some single family homes, break that down into particular sort of like modular components and then go out onto their factory line and then can be actually produced by relatively low skill labor, where like each individual member on that factory line has a very simple job. Like one person literally just, you know, drills holes. The next person just connects this wire to like this wire, but they're like extremely like low skill. Like you and I could go swap in for any of those people on the construction line and be able to actually help out versus like, I have no idea how I would like, you know, swap in to a, you know, Katerra's, you know, model and figure out how to be an electrician at Katerra. And it leads to just much, much better economics where they can deliver super, super high quality, you know, homes in the 99th percentile at like the 40th or 50th percentile of, you know, cost per square foot. And also just the floor on their construction costs is much, much lower because they're not reliant purely on labor. Like a lot of what they're starting to, you know, improve their economics by is more just providing more leverage on their labor and also just getting, you know, sort of bulk deals for some of the thing, the materials that they have to purchase. And so they actually have the ability to get down to like the, you know, sort of fifth or, you know, 10th percentile of, you know, construction costs, which, you know, typically would look like shanty homes while producing extremely high quality, beautiful units that I would be absolutely thrilled to live in. So yeah, they've produced around, you know, roughly, you know, 20 units or so today. You know, raised on the order of around $10 million, but are sort of rapidly scaling up their, you know, production and revenues and are sort of off to the races. And so it's been amazing to see, you know, the company invested maybe, you know, year and a half ago when they'd only produced maybe about six or seven sort of units total. So they've basically, you know, tripled that over the past year and a half and then also significantly improved the rate of production where they're doing, you know, roughly two or so a month now. Yeah, super excited by that team and, you know, the opportunity they're tackling. And, you know, I'm always, you know, happy to see, you know, people pursuing the, you know, lowering of housing costs. And so I think that's a lot of what has led to at least especially California's problems. And so I look forward to having more people live in super high quality homes for much cheaper prices.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. I've been like talking about for a while that I expected kind of like a Tesla of housing to come in, you know, in the 2020s at some point. Cover certainly seems like, you know, a great, if not the best candidate to kind of be that. And I didn't realize how literal that kind of was with the fact that you said that there's like a lot of Tesla people there or former Tesla people there. And I know that like a part of the strategy as well is, you know, starting with like the Roadster. And like you said, you know, it might be even out of your price range, really starting out for like the ultra wealthy. And then, you know, eventually they can launch the S and then like ultimately the three. This strategy is something that's like, you know, obviously worked very well for Tesla. It could work, you know, you could see it working very well in housing as well. Maybe a little bit different, but related to Tesla as well. I know you have investment in the self-driving car space. You did a great podcast with your colleague, Mike Solana, that I encourage people to go listen to if they want like a deep dive on the self-driving car stuff. But, you know, without diving too deeply into it, you didn't really talk about like Tesla on the podcast at all. I'm curious, you know, it seems to me that, and I know you have an investment in the space, so like, I don't want to have you like, you know, contradicting anything there or anything like that, but If you're cool talking about it, I'm curious, like, what your thoughts are on Tesla's full self-driving. Obviously, it's not like literally full self-driving yet, but do you think that they have a shot to be kind of the first winners in the space?
Yeah, I mean, the reason that we, you know, were so excited about the company that I sort of discussed in that podcast with Solana was because their sort of infrastructure and architecture was actually most similar to Tesla. Like, sometimes the way that we would describe the company to other investors as to why we invested was we would describe them as they're Tesla, but for everybody else, because you know, the Audis, et cetera, of the world don't know how to develop Tesla-like software. So no, I'm a huge fan of the Tesla approach, which I would describe as sort of cheaper sensors, more reliant on vision, and more reliant on like extreme levels of data collection. Like, the way that I sort of analyze all of these companies is just look at basically what their sort of dollars per mile of data collected cost is. Because with most of these sort of machine learning AI algorithms, what matters is having a large enough training set on especially the extreme edge cases. Like, most of your miles that you collect in terms of data are actually completely useless, right? Like, after you have like, you know, 100,000 miles of driving on like the 280, the 100,000 and first mile is like basically completely useless, because like, you know, but you know, when you are encountering a, you know, semi truck rolling over, or you know, construction blocking off half of the highway, those are the types of miles that are incredibly valuable and actually train the algorithm on completely new edge cases. Because the way that I sometimes think about sort of self-driving is like, what you really want to do is like, you don't want to drive in a new way, right? Like, there's a lot of instincts that humans have around when they see a car approaching in a particular way or at a stop sign, you know, at a red light, you sort of intuit like what the human is thinking. And so what you ideally want to do is you don't want to drive like a machine. You just want to drive like a human would drive in every scenario. And the best way to know how to drive like a human is to have data about how a human has driven in this particular scenario before. And at the end of the day, all that matters is how much data you've collected. And so when you look at companies like Cruise and you look at like the amount of data and miles they've driven relative to the total, like, you know, budget of the company, you know, you're talking on the order of like, you know, tens of dollars, if not hundreds to thousands of dollars per mile driven. And so if you want to get to, you know, a billion miles, you're talking about, you know, quite the budget of, you know, of capital going towards just doing the data collection, let alone the actual, like, you know, product development, versus, you know, both, you know, Tesla and the, you know, company that you're referencing, Ghost, basically have incredibly, you know, sort of cheap data collection because of both, you know, sort of the, you know, cheap sensors, and then also just the number of miles driven sort of in the vehicles that are outfitted with their sensors. And so, you know, Tesla is probably on the order of like a tenth of a cent, and, you know, Ghost, just, you know, because of the subscale and, you know, doesn't have access to the whole Tesla user base, is probably on the order of like, you know, half a cent per mile, but, you know, still orders and orders of magnitude cheaper versus the Cruise, Zooks, Waymos of the world. And so, yeah, fundamentally, if I had to, you know, place a bet on the, you know, self-driving race, I would absolutely put it on, you know, Tesla, you know, being number one, and Ghost being, you know, a very fast number two, that is for, you know, the rest of, you know, the rest of the, you know, car market beyond Tesla, since I don't think Tesla is going to be like, you know, allowing other automakers to, you know, retrofit Tesla's, you know, sensor stack onto their vehicles, versus that's the explicit goal for, you know, Ghost.
Yeah, it's a really interesting perspective, and I'm glad I asked, because it's, you know, it adds to my understanding from what you were talking about with Solana. You know, we have about 10 minutes left here. I want to touch on like a few different kind of random topics. You're interested in a lot of interesting things that overlap with myself. So one thing I read, you know, you actually wrote back in, I think it was 2012 when you were an intern at Square. You wrote a few blogs that I was able to read. One of them, you were talking about like how it's important to, I guess one of your friends had met like Sergey Brin and like didn't have anything to say. And you wrote about like the importance of, you know, always having basically a pitch or like at least something interesting to talk about in case you run into like Elon Musk in a coffee shop or something like that. You know, and in that article, you talked like just in passing, you gave an example of like one thing you could be ready to talk about would be like online currency. And I kind of took note because that was like 2012. Were you paying attention to crypto back then? And, you know, if not, or if you were, would just love to hear like your perspective on crypto, if you have one, and how long you've kind of been following or aware of the space.
Huh, that is actually extremely funny. I mean, yeah, I've been a long time, let's say, like, you know, follower of the space, but you know, generally have been relatively like hands off in terms of both like financial and personal involvement. Like, you know, I think it's an interesting industry. I'm glad that it's having the success that it has. but you know, hasn't been something that I guess I personally have been like super, you know, passionate about or thought about a ton. So it's actually kind of funny to see. I mean, I can imagine in 2012, I was at Square and so I was a little bit maybe deeper in the world of like, you know, financial services and thinking about this stuff. And obviously, you know, Jack even at the time was, you know, thinking about and talking about Bitcoin. You know, yeah, unfortunately, you know, maybe should have back then, you know, put some capital into Bitcoin. But, you know, was kind of more focused on, you know, more focused on sort of putting that capital to work into myself instead. And so I think at the end of the day, that was probably the better bet. But yes, you know, definitely, you know, I'd say, both myself and FF as a whole, you know, we're definitely, you know, Bitcoin bulls, and think that, you know, Bitcoin maximalists, let's say, and think that that is going to be the, you know, largest market, you know, crypto coin for, you know, for an extended long period of time. But then excited to also see sort of, you know, some of the, you know, regulatory changes that are starting to accept some of this, you know, the OCC passing the, you know, recognizing blockchain as a, you know, sort of similar technology to, you know, Swift and some of the other sort of banking APIs is, you know, great to see that, people are starting to adopt this stuff at scale. There's obviously some of the more worrying stuff around some of the data collection that some regulators want to do, but, you know, net, I think it's great that, you know, the Fed and banks have a little bit more, you know, competition, and, you know, wind or, you know, some headwinds ahead of them if they, you know, want to sort of keep printing money in an unfettered way. There's, you know, sort of,
I like
a true alternative.
I'm sorry. You, are you there?
Oh yeah. Say, hey, sorry.
Sorry. You faded out there for a second. And it's happened a few times over the course of the podcast, but I think I should be able to cut it up fine. It's just like every once in a while. Okay. Last couple things. Another interesting technology, GPT-3, you wrote about it a bit. I know you were playing with it earlier. You know, it was all the hype for a little bit and now it's kind of faded off into the background. I'm sure a lot of people are still like really excited about it. Is there anything that you've seen kind of developing or bubbling up since kind of the hype cycle might have, you know, worn out a bit that you're really excited about seeing actual applications, you know, using GPT-3 coming out in the near future, or you know, it's totally fine if you're not as well?
Yeah, I mean, there's two sort of early stage companies that are, you know, utilizing GPT-3 and have sort of, you know, partnerships with OpenAI that are, you know, building, I mean, still extremely early stage businesses, but they are like real businesses. There's Paul Yacobin with his, you know, copywriting tool, basically helping copywriters come up with, you know, various like ad copy. Like one of the most difficult things is you're sort of doing, you know, D2C marketing is, you know, you're best off, you know, advertising on Facebook when you have like 100 different variants that allow Facebook to sort of A/B test its way into what resonates most with your audience. But as a copywriter, it can sometimes be tough to actually create like 100 high quality and quite unique variants, but turns out that's something that GPT-3 is actually like really good at. And so he's starting to build up, you know, I think he actually posted his like MRR numbers publicly, but I think he like just crossed like somewhere around, you know, 60 or 70K MRR. So again, super early stage business, but still interesting to see that somebody's actually getting to some level of scale built on top of GPT-3. And then there's a set of founders that I'm forgetting the name of the company or their name that basically are doing sort of like email autocomplete tools based off of GPT-3 that are at a roughly, you know, maybe similar, slightly subscale in comparison to that, you know, stage. And so there's clearly, you know, some developers that are actually now starting to build commercial businesses on it. And then, you know, I think it was a day or 2 days ago, OpenAI just released a sort of version of GPT-3 that allows you to put in basically like, you know, freeform text for describing a image. And then GPT-3 actually generates the image. You can put like, you know, a snail made of corkscrew or a, you know, a penguin, you know, dancing at the edge of a cliff. They actually come up with cute little kind of like, you know, illustrations of describing sort of what you typed out. So it's super interesting to see the, you know, capabilities of their software and how rapidly they're expanding. But yeah, those are probably the two sort of, let's say, you know, most interesting, you know, developments is people actually commercializing on top of GPT-3, and then also them starting to, you know, at OpenAI starting to expand the use cases of, you know, types of, let's say, quote unquote APIs that GPT-3 offers beyond just, you know, text generation. Now they're doing image generation.
Right. So I ended the podcast with Keith. I asked him about, you know, a few of the most interesting people he's worked with, from Peter Thiel to Elon Musk and Jack Dorsey and people like that, and kind of what he had learned from them. Curious to ask you the same question to close this one out, starting with Keith and then maybe a couple other people you've worked with, some of the most interesting learnings. You know, I know you have a long form podcast with Eric Thornburg about specifically like lessons from Keith, and you've written a lot about it as well. But really, if we could just like be, you know, super specific and just like pick one thing that like comes to mind, like very often and has been like very useful for you, be curious to hear what that might be.
Yeah, I mean, I think the somewhat pithy way of putting it that is, you know, kind of my, one of my favorite quotes from Keith is, on average, if you look in Silicon Valley, the like quote unquote success rate of startups that are like, you know, decently funded, have the right teams, et cetera, are like roughly, you know, 10%. But Keith's belief, and this is something that he's really imprinted in me, is basically like, if you don't do, or if you just avoid all the dumb shit, like you can actually get it so that your, you know, success rate is actually closer to basically 50-50, where it actually has sometimes more to do, which is kind of like macro environments. Did you choose the right idea? You know, timings of fundraisings, and you can actually significantly improve your success rate. And so I do actually think that like operating is actually a science, and it's a lot of little things, and a lot of those little things sometimes can be counterintuitive, but if you do all the little things correctly, it sort of does add up to actually significantly impacting your, you know, success rate. And so I guess maybe the book that encapsulates this ethos the most that, you know, Keith loves to recommend is by, you know, the former 49ers coach called The Score Takes Care of Itself. I don't actually love football or anything, but it's a great book that describes like one of the ways that they, his management philosophy around his football team was, rather than try to focus on like, hey, we need to win the Super Bowl, he instead focused on just like all the little things. Like he trained the secretaries how, you know, how to pick up the phone and what the script was. He made sure that everybody had their like shirts tucked in at practice. It was just like by focusing on all the little details that actually can add up to, you know, significantly impacting your net success. And I think that's probably one of the things that I've like learned the most from, is like just do all the little things correctly, recruit the right people, spend like, make sure that the board decks are actually high quality, make sure that you're talking to the right investors, make sure that you're consistently telling the story, make sure that you're, you know, putting in the hours. And in some ways, if you quote unquote, you know, trust the process, that can actually be what makes your startup successful, way more so than sort of like the, you know, pure vision or sort of out there or like, you know, extreme energies. It's just like, do all the little things correctly, and that'll add up to a big thing.
All right. So I know we're really running close on time now, but I actually do have one more question I forgot. And then we'll wrap things up, I promise. But, you know, you had the tweet that went out that the mayor of Miami responded to. I had the mayor on 2 days ago and recorded with him on the podcast. That blew up, went viral. He said, how can I help? You said, you know, before that you said, could hear me out. Could Miami be the next Silicon Valley? I don't know if you're down there or thinking about going down there, but would be curious to hear like how crazy that was to just kind of blow up. And now Miami for the last month has been just like all the rage, and he's obviously doing great work, Mayor Suarez. Curious to hear your thoughts on like, maybe, you know, on the one side, the exit from Silicon Valley, and on the other side, the potential for Miami.
Yeah, but I think just like, you know, my comments on Bitcoin, I think it's just great that there's more competition, right? The fact that like San Francisco officials now have to deal with like the Miami mayor stealing their constituents one by one and like removing their tax revenue is just going to force them to operate at a higher level than they've ever had to, right? I think, you know, SF, you know, politicians have been able to be relatively complacent because they felt like they sort of had, you know, network effects and a monopoly they could never be, you know, challenged, versus now it's very clearly, you know, proven to not be the case. You know, unfortunately, I haven't gotten to, you know, participate as much in that exodus, partially because, you know, just started Varda and, you know, definitely basing the company in California, and we very much have to be an in-person company, can't do remote, kind of hard to build space remotely. And so I'm pretty locked into, you know, California for sure for the next 5 years, in particular the Bay Area at minimum for the next, you know, 2 years. And so can't participate in that exodus. And the tweet was partially motivated by I actually tweeted it maybe, you know, 5 or 6 minutes after SF sort of announced their latest, like, out, you know, outdoor dining lockdowns. And so it was originally sort of a pithy tweet of just like frustration, because like I'd been pretty, let's say, you know, not on the Miami bandwagon, and then saw sort of the, you know, shutdown of outdoor dining. I was like, oh my God, this is just like so unscientific, unprincipled with data. We have like no COVID in San Francisco. None of that spread is happening via outdoor dining. And that by shutting everything down, you might actually encourage spread because people are going to hang out indoors together. And so somewhat, you know, sent off the pithy tweet being like, oh my God, like now I kind of get it. I'm like, you know, hear me out, guys. What if we move Silicon Valley to Miami? But yeah, I definitely was not expecting that level of response. And it's been amazing to see, you know, how Mayor Suarez has really, you know, leaned into this trend and, you know, created a real moment. And so, you know, excited that we also, you know, get to benefit from that at Founders Fund, given that we have Keith down there. And so, you know, if San Francisco succeeds, great. I'm here and happy to ride that wave. And if Miami succeeds, thankfully we've got Keith down there to ride the wave as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think it'll go down potentially, you know, seeing what Miami does, it could go down as quite a historic tweet. You know, I want to wrap things up here. I really appreciate you taking the time today, Deli, and sharing all this stuff, and looking forward to, you know, seeing your success as an investor, but also with Varda Space, just working on some fascinating things. So looking forward to keeping, you know, in the loop on those things. Wrapping up, where can people follow you on, you know, Twitter, follow Varda Space when they have public announcements, things like that?
Yeah. So, for myself, I'm at Zebulgar. That's, Zebulgar. In regards to Varda, probably the easiest is just go to, you know, varda.com or blog.varda.com, you know, and sign up there for, you know, any announcements. But you know, I'll typically tweet out everything, you know, Varda related. That's, you know, big news as well. So following me can get you that info too.